Welcome to our discussion on Preparing for Destiny. I'm John Streeter.
And I'm Joe Parker.
Let's get started. Joe, I'm amazed that you were able to synthesize almost 90 years of history down to 30 minutes. I'm impressed.
I was not able to.
Well, I mean, you did a pretty good job.
Well, thank you. This was one of the harder episodes, and I found that you and I run into extremes on either end. Either we have topics that it's hard sometimes to fill the entire time allowed, mm-hmm. or it's a topic where how do we condense it?
You know, we do our best.
Yeah.
All right, I have quite a list of questions for you. I want to start with the story at the beginning, where it was Churchill falling into like a creek or something along those lines.
Right,
what was the significance of that moment, and why did you choose to start with that?
The impact of the entire episode was dealing with major events. And so when reading about his life, and just a really quick note, the book by Andrew Roberts, Churchill, Walking with Destiny, was the only way I could write these two episodes. He presented Churchill in a way that went beyond the timeline and the actions he took. He presented the person of Churchill in the way of a story, where as you read the book or as you hear it on audio, you feel like you know the man, that by the end of it, you are sad that he has left.
Mm-hmm.
And so I picked this story because it was an encapsulating moment of how he saw life. He could have been upset that he fell in the stream, but he wasn't. He just sat there and he continued to talk and was very playful and jovial about it. And then just accepting where he was, decided, okay, I'm done here. It's time to roll on.
Okay. So who were the companions who were with him?
His wife, Clemmy, and his friend.
Okay. Oh, so this happened when he was an adult.
Yeah.
Okay, because it sounded like maybe it was you know, him as a teenager or something like that. But yeah. No, this happened to him as an adult. Was he prime minister at this point?
He was not.
He was not. Okay, yeah. Interesting. All right, let's start with his parents, Randolph and Jenny.
Yes.
What were they like, and why did they neglect Winston and his brother Jack?
I think in the aristocracy at the time, it was very common to put your kids in boarding schools and send them away. So it was very cultural. I think even though it was cultural, I don't want to use that as an excuse, because there are recorded postcards of a 6-year-old, 7-year-old Churchill writing to his parents, begging them to come and see him, telling them stories about what he was trying to do at school to try and entice them to come and see. And so it's heartbreaking to read. When I say I don't want to give culture the cultural norm of sending your kids to school as an excuse, because there were parents who would go and see their kids a lot and would interact a lot.
It's even just, in the aristocracy?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. And obviously it varied, but Lord Randolph was very preoccupied with his work, and his mom, as said in the podcast, was very preoccupied with her social life.
Okay.
So it... everything else took a back seat to those two priorities.
Did they ever reconcile, Churchill and his father? Did his father ever say, you know what, I'm proud of you? Did his mother ever get involved in his life later on?
There was a conversation during his time in school that he had with his father, and it was a very short one. It was in the evening, and Churchill recalls that his father, upon finishing the conversation, told him, "We have just talked more than I spoke to your grandfather our entire life."
Wow.
And so there was this sense of Churchill constantly trying to show his dad, look what I can do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that may have been one of the reasons why he didn't behave well at these schools, besides the possible abuse that he had at the schools.
Yeah.
But it was this constant need to show him and relate to him and get to know him. And he continued that even after his father's death.
Right. That was much of his political career, was kind of following in his father's footsteps.
Absolutely. Including the writing of a biography of his dad, where mm-hmm. he kind of embellished a lot of the achievements his dad had or didn't have. That was one of the first things that Churchill ever wrote. And it was kind of accepted. But a lot of people who had known his father were very much like, you've kind of padded this a bit.
Okay. Interesting. Speaking of him as a writer, how accurate are his recollections of, and I mean, are his books history or are they autobiography? I mean, do historians look to Churchill's memoirs, to The River War, to his other earlier books as an objective recitation of the facts, or is it more about kind of embellishing some of his own experiences?
I think that's a big question, because it really depends on who the historian is and what their aim is. So I think that...
Yeah, but I'm talking about the text. I'm not talking about the historian, but is the text pretty accurate to what actually happened?
I mean, it depends. I think almost all the time it's fairly accurate. Churchill went into a lot of detail, or he took great pains to be as detailed as he could. Now, there were examples where he was not as detailed, like with the Gallipoli campaign, when mm-hmm. he referenced it. He didn't talk about the severity of the losses in a way that people should appreciate. Mm-hmm.
You're talking about in his First World War memoir?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I mean, he just talked about the loss of life being low. Like, he didn't mention the fact that an entire battleship had capsized mm-hmm. and thousands of people had. So he definitely downplayed some of the things that he did wrong and tried to say that this wasn't really as big a deal as everybody thought it was. But overall, it was fairly solid.
Okay. Talking about his career, he was not a good student. He may have suffered abuse, as you said, and I've read that before as well. But once he was out of school and joined the army, why did he join the cavalry? Because my understanding was, in terms of British, the proper place for the son of an aristocrat was either in the navy or in the infantry in the army. So why the cavalry?
So I believe the reason was because his scores were not high enough in school to actually qualify for anything else.
And his scores on the entrance exams at Sandhurst?
Yeah.
Was it about that, or was it about his scores or his performance in school?
His entrance exams, from what I remember, were just barely passing.
Okay. So he had to kind of go to the second
second
rank, all right, and be a member of the cavalry. Okay. Another bit about kind of his early life, his speech impediment. We know that he did have one. What was it, and how did he eventually overcome it? I know it was a part of his kind of speaking style and what gave him that unique tone, but how did it manifest, and how was he able to get over it?
So I believe it was he couldn't pronounce L's very well, that he had a lisp.
Okay.
And so what he did was he kind of contrived this growl, a way to actually get the word out without having that add-on, I'll call it.
Okay.
And so it was a very, very practiced application of trying to correct an impediment. And again, it was specifically with L's.
Okay, interesting. All right, let's get into his career. The quote you read about his first experience in combat, where he talks about, you know, it was a pretty jolly experience. What would possess a person who has seen death and destruction on that scale to write something like, so a lot of people were killed, and on our side, their widows had to be pensioned off by the imperial government, and it was all very exciting, and for those who did not get killed or hurt, it was very jolly. What does that show about his character? Because he was, after all, a flawed person.
Yeah, it's a great question. So I think the first thing I would consider is the context in which he said it. As he was being asked about this, and as he made this statement, it was part of a progression of questions about this time. So I think that this particular quote, I chose it because it showed his sarcastic side. And I think also, I don't think that his tone was reflective of the kind of person he was. I think that...
You think it wasn't a reflection?
I do not. Okay. I think that because his actions...
Then why would he use this tone?
I mean, why did he use a tone that he usually used in war and in peacetime? He was a very sarcastic guy. I'm not justifying his words, but... When you look at what he actually did in that battle, mm-hmm. he did not take it lightly.
What did he do?
So he actually worked to save people. He had acts of valor where he put himself in harm's way to actually save others. It's very much like if you asked a combat veteran to give a rundown of a battle or a hard experience, mm-hmm. A lot of the veterans that I talk to will not go into extreme detail and make it a serious conversation because it is in fact so serious.
Okay.
They don't want to dive into it.
Okay.
They'll crack a joke. They'll be like, "Yeah, it's sucked," or something, you know, or they just won't say anything. Mm. So I think it's better to see the actions he took in that battle versus the way he described it later on.
That makes sense. So he spent some time in Cuba.
Yes.
What was he doing there?
He went there as kind of an advisor.
Who? The Spanish, the Cuban rebels, or the Americans?
An advisor/helper to the Cubans.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he was pro-Cuban independence.
Correct.
So this is right before the Spanish-American War, where we intervened to win Cuba's independence, or help them win their independence. Is that when he first met William Randolph Hearst, or did he meet him later on?
I believe he met him later on.
Okay, because Hearst was very involved in that conflict. I was curious if there was a connection there. Once we get into the war, you covered his time at the Admiralty very, very well, and I don't really have any questions about that or about Gallipoli, except to say that, wow, like I said, you covered it pretty well, and we've discussed it in an earlier episode, which, by the way, everyone should listen to. Way back in season one, we did a two-episode survey of the First World War that was, I think, pretty good. So
I agree.
We should check that.
It's our second highest in terms of downloads.
There we go.
Yeah.
So yeah, you should check that one out. But I want to focus on his experiences in the trenches. What was it like for him to be fighting alongside common British soldiers who were not members of his kind of social class, especially in command of a Scottish regiment instead of an English regiment? What was that like for him?
I would say it was eye-opening. That was something that no one had experienced the trenches like they experienced them in that war. And so when he...
You mean no one experienced combat like they did?
So I think that trench warfare obviously has been in use for a long time, but World War I really solidified that, I'll call it a tactic, in a way that no one had ever experienced up to that point. And Churchill going to the front was a way, as I said, to redeem himself. And getting there was very, very eye-opening. For one, there are countless accounts of him barely escaping death, whether it be a shell landing in his headquarters or his house or right where he had been standing. So there was that. And he was aware of that.
Mm-hmm.
He did, however, believe that his purpose, which was much higher than being in a trench. So he had the belief that he didn't believe that he was invulnerable, but he thought, I do not believe I'm going to die here.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
But he took a lot of pleasure in watching the soldiers enjoy the little things. He was very struck by that, because coming from aristocracy, that's not something you think through, right? So,
a letter from home,
a cup of tea, a piece of shortbread, some jam on a cracker. All of these things he would watch them just be so full of joy over, and he remembered that. And I think that fed into his attitude towards almost everything. And when you read about his actions during World War II and how he did, you see that reflected in how he would take pleasure in the small things in life, whether it be a silly film that he watched at night or cracking one of his millions of jokes. I think he also saw the futility of trench warfare. It wasn't something, as a student of history, as someone who was well-read, he just saw that this is going nowhere. This is a stalemate.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember, some of his later on political allies and partners were actually in the trenches with him in that same regiment. Do you remember off the top of your head who some of those
were?
I think actually Clement Attlee was in his regiment, who was his deputy.
You would probably know better than me.
Yeah, I think Attlee was in his regiment, or maybe I know they first met during the war, and Attlee, of course, was head of the Labour Party and was Churchill's deputy during World War II, and ultimately beat him in the 1945 campaign. More on that next week. Did he read a lot during the while he was in the trenches? You talked about how he was a voracious reader.
Hard to ship things to the trenches.
Yeah. So what did he request from his wife Clementine at that stage?
Just really some things: socks,
cigars.
Yeah. I think, and he would share those. I think the simple things that he saw other soldiers taking pleasure in, he adopted for himself. Mm-hmm. So he wasn't asking for extravagance or anything else, because it wouldn't last in there.
Oh,
The trenches destroyed everything. I mean, it just destroyed everything.
Yeah. How many cigars did he smoke?
In his life?
Either in his life or during an average day, do you know?
So I will say, before I answer that, his hat, his cigar, all of that was intentional. He always wanted to be seen a specific way in order to help himself stand out from any crowd.
And the fact that it looked like a 65-year-old toddler.
Or a bulldog. Either one, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I haven't thought
You've never
of it.
Heard
no,
oh,
I've
oh, yeah.
never heard of that.
Almost every photo that you see, except for the
well, now I see it.
Except for the really famous one where he's glaring at the Yeah, the photo Joe's holding up the Roberts book. That's the photo where he looks like a bulldog. That's his classic.
But now I'm gonna be Canada. Now you like tainted.
Oh yeah. Open the book and find other pictures of him as an adult, and all of you should find photos of him. Yeah, online. He looks like a 65-year-old toddler. He's got the round head and the big eyes.
Yeah, that's a great point. That's a great point.
Anyway, cigars. What do you know? Like, how many he smoked or anything like that?
It depended on the day. I don't think he was a General Grant.
Okay, so it wasn't 20 a day, correct, like General Grant.
Favorite type were Cuban cigars.
Yeah.
I think one of the brands that still exists today that he really loved was Romeo and Juliet brand.
Okay.
And
so the actual number is actually found in the Churchill book, In Walking with Destiny. He smoked about 156,000 cigars during his lifetime. Which
he did not die of cancer.
He did not.
He did die of a stroke, which is, you know.
Which can, be caused by it. So we're not here endorsing the smoking of cigars or anything like that.
Just to be clear. I do know that when he went to see FDR at the White House the first time, people knew him as the guy who would always have a cigar.
Oh, yeah.
And as a result, he received thousands of boxes of cigars from people who were excited that he was there. They would send him books and all these gifts, and they received so many boxes of cigars that they had to get through security first, and so you had the Secret Service opening all of these boxes
really?
To make sure there wasn't they were trying to test for like poisons and other things. So of the thousands, I think only a small fraction actually made it to Churchill.
Probably,
yeah.
Interesting. During his first period where he was kind of out of power during World War One, a meme developed about Winston Churchill, and it was quoted later on that he has 100 ideas each day. 97 of them are awful, but 3 are absolutely brilliant. Do you agree with that assessment of Churchill, and was he just supremely lucky that there was only really one major disaster of his career, and that was Gallipoli?
You know, he did have a lot of ideas, so I would agree with that part. Was it just 3? You know, I don't know. But
I mean that most of his ideas were actually bad. They just, other people were kind of covering for him and saying, no, Winston, let's not do that.
He knew himself to be a flawed man. And so I think that a lot of his ideas came from the excitement that he had to not only understand them and get to the point where he would want to share them. Mm-hmm. Cause he loved learning. He loved understanding. He loved learning about things that he hadn't heard of or things that were new. So I think part of it was his excitement to present an idea. I think sometimes they were out of place and weren't the right timing. Like he was one of the biggest proponents of a tank.
And I was going to ask you about that. Yeah. What was his role in that?
So he saw the advantages of a tank, but it was a little premature for the timing for the English to actually spend money to create these new machines of war. I think that he was a proponent of that, but I don't know that there was a lot of support for it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
So I kind of answered you and I kind of didn't. Sorry. It's difficult for me sitting here today to say most of his ideas were bad.
Yeah.
I can only look at what I see in history and understand him to be a man out of place until it was the right time for him to be and serve in the role that he was always preparing for.
Okay.
So before that time, were some of his ideas bad? Absolutely. Were almost all of them bad? I don't know.
Okay. And then his time as Home Secretary, he was very involved in Irish affairs. So what was going on there?
That's a really big topic. And I was very tempted to put it into the podcast. But
so we got the Easter Rebellion in 1916 going on. And then going forward, what's he doing?
He was trying to suppress the ongoing violence there through armed intervention and literally opening fire into crowds of people.
Would you call that another failing of his?
Absolutely. Or,
okay.
Yeah.
All right.
I would call
it did not end up suppressing the violence. Obviously, Ireland did break away. They won that civil war. Did it end the violence for a time?
The complaints of the IRA at the time were seemingly validated by Churchill's responses to them.
So he made it worse.
It made it worse because, I mean, regardless of who you are, when you send troops to openly fire on civilians, that's not going to end well.
Mm-hmm.
we've never heard of that actually causing hearts and minds to turn toward a favorable outcome. And so I think that history has shown that strengthened the IRA and the force by which they applied their advance to try and pull out of Great Britain.
Okay. All right, we come to the wilderness years, and there are a couple questions I want to ask about this. He wrote Marlborough. Have you read it or read parts of it or anything like that?
I've read parts of it.
It's really frickin' long.
Yeah, so that's why.
It's like 100 hours, I think, of Audible recordings or something like that.
It's 121.
121 hours. That is unbelievable. So you've read Marlborough, or you've read parts of it?
Yes, parts of it, not nearly all of it.
Okay.
It is a long book.
What stands out from what you've read? Are there stories? Are there, like, his writing style? What really stands out to you about that book?
His style. Yeah. His style was just very much able to tell the story of history while bringing to life the characters of history.
Mm-hmm.
And the detail at which he went into each story, each scene was profound.
Okay. And he also started A History of the English-Speaking Peoples at this period. Then he put it on hold. Obviously, World War II kind of crimped his time to be able to write history.
Yeah
imagine that. Have you read any of that?
I've read the first volume.
Okay. And any thoughts on that? Do you see an evolution in his style or anything like that?
I see a refinement of his style.
Yeah. That's a shorter book.
It is
a shorter
book.
He spends less time on 2,000 years of English-speaking people's history than he does on one man's life.
He has the uncanny ability to focus on the events which actually shaped England.
Okay.
And whereas I think on the earlier version, he focused on all the events.
Yes.
Like everything.
Everything that happened in Marlborough's life. Although I will say, you said it, he focused on the events that truly shaped England's history. It actually, he missed several big ones. One of the reviewers, I think it was in the Daily Mail, which was generally a pretty pro Churchill newspaper at the time, said it should be called, instead of A History of the English-Speaking People, it should be called A History of Things That Interest Winston Churchill. Because some things he just completely went over. But anyway.
Well, so, it's his book. I suppose he can do whatever he wants.
He can do what he wants. But there's a lot of reading that that our audience should do if they're interested. There's a lot of primary source material on Churchill. While he was writing Marlborough, I know of a story where he spent some time in Germany, went to the battlefield at Blenheim, where Marlborough won his great victory over the French, and then they went to Munich. And are you familiar with the story where he actually almost had a chance to meet Adolf Hitler before?
I'm not.
Okay. So this was during, I think it was in the late 1920s. So he was not chancellor yet, and I don't even think he was starting his bid for the chancellorship, but Churchill and his family happened to be staying at the hotel where Hitler would come every day for lunch, and he would hold court there for 3 or 4 hours. And Churchill was having dinner one night, and one of Hitler's aides happened to be there, and they struck up a conversation, and the German aide, his name was Ernst Hanfstengel, spoke English, and so he was talking to Churchill and said, "Oh yeah, I could absolutely arrange an opportunity for you to meet with Hitler." And apparently Hitler either informed himself about who Churchill was, or he already knew, because Hitler canceled the appointment the next day and said, "No, I'm not going to meet with that man." That was the only opportunity where those two men could have met. It would have been an interesting kind of, like, that would have been an interesting meeting, I think. Why was he such an ardent opponent of the Nazis? Was it just his revulsion at their ideas, or was he getting, like, did he have evidence to support his beliefs that the Germans were pushing for another war? Because that was his main theme, is the Germans want a war. Everyone else in Europe is saying, no more war, never again, never again. And Churchill is going, no, look at what Hitler is saying. Look at what he is doing.
Mm-hmm.
Did he have actual evidence, or was it just he's taking Hitler at his word?
There were reports coming out that the Germans were rearming.
Mm-hmm.
And this was...
Public reports?
I think that there were public rumors, but there were reports coming out that Churchill had access to. I think also, to your earlier part of the question, he knew what Hitler was trying to accomplish. Obviously, he read Hitler's book. He understood what was driving Hitler. It wasn't just this feigning political stance that he was using to gain power. He truly believed in the evil that he was purporting.
Yeah.
And as Churchill saw him continue to gain power, he knew that that evil would be amplified and put into action.
Mm-hmm.
And upon receiving those reports that the Germans were arming up and violating all the terms of the Treaty of Versailles, he knew this man is not stopping.
Yeah.
He has shown by example that he will break treaties, he will break agreements, and he does not care. And knowing what he knew based on what Hitler was saying on his book, he understood this man will not stop. Hmm. So somebody has to stop him.
So if he's getting actual information from officials in government that he's friendly with, the prime ministers, Baldwin and then Chamberlain, the two appeasement prime ministers, they had access to the same information. So why didn't they put two and two together?
That's a great question. I think the easy answer is everyone was so tired of war
mm-hmm.
that they just didn't believe it was possible again. They didn't believe that a Germany that had been so defeated and humiliated would take the reins again and say, we're going to reengage.
Mm-hmm.
I also think that Chamberlain, he's often kind of considered a wimp. He didn't really mm-hmm. He didn't really stand up to Hitler at all. He kowtowed, he placated. But I think that there was a sincere desire from Chamberlain to keep the peace.
Mm-hmm.
Even as Hitler violated treaties and agreements, he was doing his best to say, hey, we don't want to go back to where we were. And so I'm not excusing his attempt to appease Hitler.
Yeah.
It was obviously wrong. But I think from his perspective, he wanted to avoid war at all costs. We saw the same attitude in France.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, and
I would imagine it's worse in France.
It was substantially worse.
Yeah.
And so you have all of Europe saying, we don't want to go to war. We don't believe that Germany will actually do these things. Whereas Churchill, again, man out of time, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's slowly starting to come in to a time when everything that he has prepared to be is going to be tested. And so he's seeing this rising threat. And as a result, he's one of the only ones actually speaking out about it.
Okay. And I have read some historians who have kind of interpreted Chamberlain in a slightly different way than what you've said, and I'm curious as to your thoughts about this, that he was actually playing for time. He knew that Britain's defenses in 1938 during the Munich crisis were not ready for what the Germans would launch on them when war began. So he actually appeased Hitler in 1938 to gain another year so that by 1939, the country would be more ready for war than it was in 38. Do you give any credence to that? Because that would seem to indicate that Churchill was being aggressively, naive in his he's not seeing that Chamberlain is actually playing 4D chess here.
I do not give credence.
You don't?
No, to that. And I think Churchill recognized how unprepared Britain was for the war, which is why he was speaking in favor of rearming.
3 years before
Munich
and all
of that. Yeah, he was saying, we need to get ready right now. I believe that Chamberlain was naive, and mm-hmm. he thought we can appease this man who is Hitler. We don't agree with him. We think he's evil, but we don't want a war, and
okay.
we don't think he's going to actually do all the things he's talking
yeah.
about. Because who could think that way? And so I don't believe it was part of this 4D chess move. I think that or chess play. I think that he genuinely thought if we do A, B, and C, Hitler will back off.
Okay. Fair enough.
How do you feel about that? I'm going to use my second poll. Like as a professional historian,
yeah.
how do you see it?
I think you're right. If Chamberlain truly was trying to play for time, he would have been more aggressive in 1937 when he came into office at rearmament. And he grudgingly supported some rearmament begun by the Baldwin government before him, but he did not put the full energy of the British military into rearmament. He was still trying to hold them back in some ways. And so I think that supports the conclusion that you've drawn. So I got to jump back just a little bit, but still during the wilderness years, you didn't touch on the abdication crisis at all. Was that a conscious choice or was that a choice because of time and space, or was that not one of the key moments that built towards his premiership?
It was a time issue.
Okay.
Churchill was a big fan of Edward, and he actually tried to enact a arrangement that would keep him on the throne.
Mm-hmm.
And he was not very popular for trying to arrange that. And because it went against the Church of England, it went against most what people wanted the outcome to
yeah.
be. And so he actually did lose some political cred for a little bit as a result of that whole thing. Mm-hmm. But it was genuine. I mean, he loved the king. He loved the monarchy, and he just didn't want to see it so torn. Mm-hmm. And so he did everything he could, going above and beyond, to try and salvage what was happening there.
Yeah. And that leads into his relationship with George VI, with the man who replaced Edward VIII after his abdication. What was the relationship between the two of them? Because if you read Churchill's war memoirs, History of the Second World War, they were best of friends. There was never any kind of resentment or anything like that. And yet when you read other historians, though interestingly not Roberts, they emphasize the fact that there was a great deal of resentment felt by the king toward Churchill, and that Churchill really kind of thought, this new guy, he does not have what it takes. At least in the beginning, once they were together in the war, there was a great deal of respect and mutual respect and mutual admiration. But what was the relationship early on?
Someone in Church's life said this. I'm trying to remember. It was a quote that said, "When you first meet Winston, you see all of his faults, mm-hmm. but as you get to know him, you learn about all of his virtues." And I think that he came across as a very brash individual. Very, very loud, very witty, sarcastic. Mm-hmm. I think hilarious, but obviously, when coming like that to the king, especially at the beginning, when he had advocated so much in favor of his brother to retain the throne, I think that there were some challenges there. But the more that he and Winston worked together, the more that they talked, the less challenges there were.
Mm-hmm. All right, we're getting pretty long here, so just a couple more quick questions. Churchill, again, during the wilderness years, he took up painting. Tell us about his career as an amateur painter.
I know that if you find his paintings now, they're very expensive.
Yes.
Just a little bit.
That's true.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoy his paintings. Mm-hmm. He took a lot of pleasure in it because he could turn off his mind. It was a way that he could immerse himself into something that was pure joy. Mm-hmm. And so, obviously, he loved landscapes, and Chartwell actually is this gigantic landscape.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
and it's so beautiful.
Yeah, it absolutely is.
Have you been to the UK?
I have not been to the UK.
Okay, yeah.
I've seen pictures.
Going to Chartwell was very, very special. I enjoyed going,
yeah, I'm sure.
going there.
Is the pond still there?
It is. And I was going to ask if you knew, what did he paint the most? What was his favorite landscape? It was that pond.
Yeah.
He had it installed shortly after his fourth daughter, Marigold, was born. And she's the one who tragically passed away of sepsis.
Okay.
I think shortly before she was 2 years old. That pond reminded him of her.
I really enjoyed reading about his time at Chartwell, just his love for it. He would be able to walk to the pond and call the fish, and mm-hmm. they would actually come to the surface.
Mm-hmm. And him scolding the geese.
His scolding the geese, yeah, yeah. yeah.
Which brings me to the last question. You mentioned this person once, but she was the constant companion and the anchor in his life. Tell us about Clementine Churchill. We'll save a discussion of his kids for next week. But tell us about Clementine.
She was his great love, the constant in his life, his supporter. She was surprisingly outspoken at times mm-hmm. when she was supporting him. Very direct with some people when he was insulted.
Mm-hmm. And with him, if she thought he was wrong,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely, yeah. I love the nicknames that they had. He would call her Cat. Mm-hmm. And he would all this stuff. He would draw pictures of cats on his cards to her and his notes. And when she was pregnant, the cats would also be pregnant. And she called him Pug and like all these cute names. And mm-hmm.
so their relationship, obviously, it started kind of late in life, technically.
Didn't she?
I know she had rejected a couple suitors before. Did she reject Winston? So
she almost did because he was late to the engagement.
Oh, that's right.
He slept in because he was he had this whole thing arranged,
yeah.
but he slept in that day and his friend actually bailed him out.
That's hilarious.
Like took her for a tour of the grounds because he was ticked off.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, I'm leaving. I'm done with this.
That's
she actually
right.
was planning to leave.
Okay.
And so Churchill realized like his friend contacted and be like, you need to get over here.
Yeah.
Like he's like, he realized his error and got dressed and went over and
yeah.
and proposed, but
that was a close one.
Yeah, it was a close one.
And to close this out, Churchill, many historians discuss his bouts of depression, his black dog that he called it. How did, one, Clementine help him through that, or did she? What was her role in all of that? And two, did that depression, what impact did it have on his early life, his pre-World War II life? Because it seems like it goes away once he's in power and running the war. And what was his, how did his depression affect his decision making and his process of becoming the man that he was?
I think she did encourage him in those times when he felt, you can't summarize depression by saying you feel down.
Right.
Right. But yeah. when he was in those pits of trying to claw his way out, I think, you know, we've referenced in this conversation a couple of times that he seemed to be a man out of time until his time came. And I think that that was a contributing factor to him being depressed, was he was made fun of.
Mm-hmm.
He was made fun of almost his entire life. He did things that people thought were weird.
He looked like a 62-year-old toddler.
Yeah. But I mean, like, he used words that people didn't use anymore. Mm-hmm. He used oratory flourishes that no one saw the need for. People thought he would overstate things and that they didn't take him, they didn't see him as a serious person.
Hmm.
And I think all of that went into just the perception that he had of himself, influenced by his upbringing and the need to constantly try and prove himself to a father that was long dead. And
do you think that's where it started?
I think so.
Yeah.
I mean, how do you not get depressed when you start out life that way?
Mm-hmm.
I said this at the beginning, those postcards that he wrote to his mom, begging her to come see him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, begging her to come see him. And she wasn't.
It's awful.
It's awful. So to your comment, he didn't enjoy the war, but that is what he was made for. And one of the things that is helpful, as he stated, with his depression is being active, constantly working, constantly driving towards a goal that was seen or unseen, to involve himself in an action outside of his own mind that would drive him on. And so that she encouraged that. And that's something that certainly kept him going to become the man that he would need to be for the Second World War.
Thank you for joining us in our discussion of Preparing for Destiny. I'm John Streeter.
And I'm Joe Parker.
Be sure to leave us a review wherever you listen to this podcast. It really does help. Thanks, and we'll see you next week.